fiery body. His small hands moved deftly across the carving, shaving fine curls of wood with a sharp knife as he shaped the images. He had white skin and a lot of bushy red hair. "He's not very handsome," Alice had said with a twist of her lip, when Caris admitted she had fallen in love with him. It was true that Merthyn did not have the dashing good looks of his brother Ralph, but Caris thought his face was quite marvellous, irregular and quirky and wise and full of laughter, just as he was. "Hello," she said, and he jumped. She laughed. "It's not like you to be so easily spooked." "You startled me." He hesitated, then kissed her. He seemed a little awkward, but that sometimes happened when he was concentrating on his work. She looked at the carving. There were five virgins on each side of the door, the wise ones feasting at the wedding, and the foolish ones outside, holding their lamps upside down to show that they were empty of oil. Merthyn had copied the design of the old door, but with subtle changes. The virgins stood in rows, five on one side and five on the other, like the arches in the cathedral. But in the new door, they were not exactly alike. Merthyn had given each girl a sign of individuality. One was pretty, another had curly hair, one wept, another closed one eye in a mischievous wink. He had made them real, and the scene on the old door now looked stiff and lifeless by comparison. "It's wonderful," Caris said, "but I wonder what the monks will think." "Brother Thomas likes it," Merthyn replied. "What about Prior Anthony?" "He hasn't seen it, but he'll accept it. He won't want to pay twice." That was true, Caris thought. Her uncle Anthony was unadventurous but parsimonious, too. The mention of the prior reminded her of her errand. "My father wants you to meet him and the prior at the bridge." "Did he say why?" "I think he's going to ask Anthony to build a new bridge." Merthyn put his tools into a leather satchel and quickly swept the floor, brushing sawdust and wood shavings out of the porch. Then he and Caris walked in the rain through the fair and down the main street to the wooden bridge. Caris told him what Buenaventura had said at the breakfast table. Merthyn felt, as she did, that recent fairs had not been as bustling as those he remembered from childhood. Despite that, there was a long queue of people and carts waiting to get into Kingsbridge. At the near end of the bridge was a small gatehouse where a monk sat taking a fee of one penny from every trader who entered the city with goods for sale. The bridge was narrow, so it was not possible for anyone to jump the queue, and in consequence people who did not need to pay, residents of the town mainly, also had to stand in line. In addition, some of the boards that formed the surface were twisted and broken, so carts had to move slowly as they crossed. The result was that the queue stretched away along the road between the suburban hovels and disappeared into the rain. The bridge was also too short. Once, no doubt, both its ends had given on to dry land. But either the river had widened, or, more likely, the passage of carts and people over decades and centuries had flattened the banks, so that now people had to wade across muddy beaches on both sides. Caris saw that Merthyn was studying its structure. She knew that look in his eyes. He was thinking about how it stayed upright. She often caught him staring at something in that way, usually in the cathedral, but sometimes in front of a house or even something natural, a thorn tree in blossom or a sparrow hawk hovering. He became very still, his gaze bright and sharp, as if he were shining a light into a murky place, trying to make out what was there. If she asked him, he told her he was trying to see the insides of things. She followed his gaze and strained to imagine what he perceived in the old bridge. It was 60 yards from end to end, the longest bridge she had ever seen. The roadbed was supported by massive oak piers in two rows, like the pillars that marched either side of the nave of the cathedral. There were 5 pairs of piers. The end ones, where the water was shallow, were quite short, but the 3 central pairs stood 15 feet above the waterline. Each pier consisted of 4 oak beams in a cluster, held together by plank braces. Legend said that the king had given Kingsbridge Priory the 24 best oak trees in England to build the 3 central pairs of piers. The tops were linked by beams in 2 parallel lines. Shorter beams crossed from one line to the other, forming the roadbed, and longitudinal planks had been laid on top to form the road surface. On each side was a wooden railing that served as a flimsy parapet. Every couple of years a drunk peasant would drive a cart through the rail and kill himself and his horse in the river. "What are you looking at?" Carris asked Merthyn. "The cracks." "I don't see any. The timbers on either side of the central pier are splitting. You can see where Elfric has reinforced them with iron braces." Now that he pointed them out, Carris could see the flat metal strips nailed across the cracks. "You look worried," she said to him. "I don't know why the timbers cracked in the first place." "Does it matter?" "Of course it does." He was not very talkative this morning. She was about to ask him why when he said, "Here comes your father." She looked along the street. The two brothers made an odd pair. Tall Anthony fastidiously held up the skirts of his monkish robe and stepped gingerly around the puddles, wearing an expression of distaste on his pale indoor face. Edmund, more vigorous despite being the elder, had a red face and a long, untidy grey beard, and he walked carelessly, dragging his withered leg through the mud, speaking argumentatively and gesturing extravagantly with both arms. When Carris saw her father at a distance, the way a stranger might see him, she always felt a surge of love. The dispute was in full swing when they got to the bridge, and they continued without pause.
"Look at that queue!" Edmund shouted. "Hundreds of people not trading at the fair because they haven't got there yet, and you can be sure half of them will meet a buyer or seller while waiting and conduct their business right then and there, then go home without even entering the city."
"That's forestalling, and it's against the law," said Anthony.
"You could go and tell them that if you could get across the bridge, but you can't because it's too narrow. Listen, Anthony, if the Italians pull out, the Fleece Fair will never be the same again. Your prosperity and mine are based on the fair. We must not just let it go."
"We can't force Buenaventura to do business here, but we can make our fair more attractive than Shiring's. We need to announce a big symbolic project right now, this week. Something to convince them all that the Fleece Fair isn't finished. We have to tell them we're going to tear down this old bridge and build a new one twice as wide." Without warning, he turned to Merthyn. "How long would it take, young lad?" Merthyn looked startled, but he answered. "Finding the trees would be the hard part. You need very long timbers, well seasoned. Then the piers have to be driven into the riverbed. That's tricky because you're working in running water. After that, it's just carpentry. You could finish it by Christmas." Anthony said, "There's no certainty the Caroli family will change its plans if we build a new bridge."
"They will," Edmund said forcefully. "I guarantee it."
"Anyway, I can't afford to build a bridge. I don't have the money."
"You can't afford not to build a bridge," Edmund shouted. "You'll ruin yourself as well as the town."
"It's out of the question. I don't even know where I'm going to get the money for the repairs in the South Isle."
"So what will you do?"
"Trust in God."
"Those who trust in God and sow a seed may reap a harvest, but you're not sowing the seed."
Anthony got irritated. "I know this is difficult for you to understand, Edmund, but Kingsbridge Priory is not a commercial enterprise. We're here to worship God, not to make money.
You won't worship God for long if you've nothing to eat.
God will provide." Edmund's red face flushed with anger, turning a purplish color.
"When you were a boy, our father's business fed you and clothed you and paid for your education. Since you've been a monk, The citizens of this town and the peasants of the surrounding countryside have kept you alive by paying you rents, tithes, charges for market stalls, bridge tolls, and a dozen other different fees. All your life you've lived like a flea on the backs of hard-working people, and now you have the nerve to tell us that God provides!
That's perilously close to blasphemy.
Don't forget that I've known you since you were born, Anthony. You've always had a talent for avoiding work.
Edmund's voice, so often raised in a shout, now dropped. A sign, Carus knew, that he was really furious.
When it was time to empty out the privy, you went off to bed, so that you would be rested for school the next day. Father's gift to God. You always had the best of everything, and never lifted your hand to earn it. Strengthening food, the warmest bedroom, the best clothes. I was the only boy who wore his brother's cast-off outfits.
And you never let me forget it.
Carus had been waiting for the opportunity to halt the flow, and now she took it.
There ought to be a way around this.
They both looked at her, surprised to be interrupted. She went on,
for example, couldn't the townspeople build a bridge?
Don't be ridiculous, said Antony. The town belongs to the priory. A servant doesn't furnish his master's house.
But if your permission was sought, you would have no reason to refuse it.
Antony did not immediately contradict that, which was encouraging. But Edmund was shaking his head.
I don't think I could persuade them to put up the money, he said. It would be in their interests, long term, of course. But people are very reluctant to think in the long term when being asked to part with their money.
Ha! Said Antony. Yet you expect me to think long term?
You deal with eternal life, don't you?
Edmund shot back.
You, of all people, ought to be able to see beyond the end of next week. Besides, you get a penny toll from everyone who crosses the bridge. You'd get your money back, and you'd benefit from the improvement in business.
Carus said, But Uncle Antony is a spiritual leader, and he feels it's not his role.
But he owns the town,
Papa protested.
He's the only one who can do it.
Then he gave her an inquiring look, realizing that she would not have contradicted him without a reason.
What are you thinking?
Suppose the townspeople built a bridge and were repaid out of the penny tolls.
Edmund opened his mouth to express an objection, but could not think of one. Carus looked at Antony.
Antony said, When the priory was new, its only income came from that bridge. I can't give it away.
But think what you would gain if the fleece fair and the weekly market began to return to their former size. Not just the bridge tolls, but stallholders' fees, the percentage you take of all transactions at the fair, and gifts to the cathedral, too.
Edmund added, and the profits on your own sales.
Wool, grain, hides, books, statues of the saints.
Antony said,
You planned this, didn't you?
He pointed an accusing finger at his older brother.
You told your daughter what to say.
And the lad. He would never think up a scheme like this. And she's just a woman.
It has your mark on it.
This is all a plot to cheat me of my bridge tolls. Well, it's failed.
Praise God! I'm not that stupid.
He turned away and splashed off through the mud.
Edmund said, I don't know how my father ever sired someone with so little sense.
And he too stomped off. Carus turned to Merthyn.
Well, she said, what did you think of all that?
I don't know.
He looked away, avoiding her eye.
I'd better get back to work.
He went without kissing her.
Well, she said when he was out of earshot, what on earth has got into him?
Chapter 8 The Earl of Shiring came to Kingsbridge on the Tuesday of Fleece Fair Week. He brought with him both his sons, various other family members, and an entourage of knights and squires. The bridge was cleared by his advance men, and no one was permitted to cross for an hour before his arrival, lest he should suffer the indignity of being made to wait alongside the common people. His followers wore his red and black livery, and they all splashed into town with banners flying, their horses' hooves spattering the citizens with rainwater and mud. Earl Roland had prospered in the last 10 years, under Queen Isabella and later her son Edward III, and he wanted the world to know it, as rich and powerful men generally did. In his company was Ralph, son of Sir Gerald and brother of Merthyn. At the same time as Merthyn had been apprenticed to Elfric's father, Ralph had become a squire in the household of Earl Roland, and he had been happy ever since. He had been well fed and clothed, he had learned to ride and fight, and he had spent most of his time hunting and playing sports and games. In 6 1/2 years, no one had asked him to read or write a word. As he rode behind the Earl through the huddled stalls of the Fleece Fair, watched by faces both envious and fearful, he pitied the merchants and tradesmen grubbing for pennies in the mud. The Earl dismounted at the Prior's house, on the north side of the cathedral. His younger son, Richard, did the same. Richard was Bishop of Kingsbridge, and the cathedral was, theoretically, his church. However, the bishop's palace was in the county town of Shiring, 2 days' journey away. This suited the bishop, whose duties were political as much as religious, and it suited the monks, who preferred not to be too closely supervised. Richard was only 28, but his father was a close ally of the king, and that counted for more than seniority. The rest of the entourage rode to the south end of the cathedral close. The Earl's elder son, William, Lord of Castor, told the squires to stable the horses while half a dozen knights settled into the hospital. Ralph moved quickly to help William's wife, Lady Philippa, get down from her horse. She was a tall, attractive woman, with long legs and deep breasts, and Ralph nurtured a hopeless love for her. When the horses were settled, Ralph went to visit his mother and father. They lived rent-free in a small house in the southwest quarter of the town, by the river, in a neighbourhood made malodorous by the work of leather tanners. As he approached the house, Ralph felt himself shrivelling with shame inside his red and black uniform. He was grateful that Lady Philippa could not see the indignity of his parents' situation. He had not seen them for a year, and they seemed older. There was a lot of grey in his mother's hair, and his father was losing his eyesight. They gave him cider made by the monks, and wild strawberries mother had gathered in the woods. Father admired his livery. "Has the Earl made you a knight yet?" he asked eagerly. It was the ambition of every squire to become a knight, but Ralph felt it more keenly than most. His father had never got over the humiliation, 10 years ago, of being degraded to the position of pensioner of the priory. An arrow had pierced Ralph's heart that day. The pain would not be eased until he had restored the family honour. But not all squires became knights. Nevertheless, Father always talked as if it were only a matter of time for Ralph. "Not yet," Ralph said, "but we're likely to go to war with France before long, and that will be my chance." He spoke lightly, not wishing to show how badly he yearned for the chance to distinguish himself in battle. Mother was disgusted. "Why do kings always want war?" Father laughed. "It's what men were made for." "No, it's not," she said sharply. "When I gave birth to Ralph in pain and suffering, I didn't intend that he should live to have his head cut off by a Frenchman's sword, or his heart pierced by a bolt from a crossbow." Father flapped a hand at her in a dismissive gesture and said to Ralph, "What makes you say there will be war?" "King Philip of France has confiscated Gascony." "Ah, we can't have that." English kings had ruled the western French province of Gascony for generations. They had given trade privileges to the merchants of Bordeaux and Bayonne, who did more business with London than with Paris. Still, there was always trouble. Ralph said, King Edward has sent ambassadors to Flanders to form alliances. Allies may want money. That's why Earl Roland has come to Kingsbridge. The king wants a loan from the wool merchants.
How much?
The talk is of £200,000 nationwide, as an advance against the wool tax. Mother said bleakly, the king should take care not to tax the wool merchants to death. Father said, the merchants have plenty of money. Just look at their fine clothes. There was bitterness in his tone, and Ralph observed that he had on a worn linen undershirt and old shoes. Anyway, they want us to stop the French Navy interfering with their trade. Over the last year, French ships had raided towns on the south coast of England, sacking the ports and setting fire to ships in the harbours.
The French attack us, so we attack the French, said Mother. What is the sense of it?
Women will never understand,
Father replied. That's the truth, she said crisply. Ralph changed the subject.
How is my brother?
He's a fine craftsman, said his father, and he sounded, Ralph thought, like a horse salesman saying that an undersized pony was a good mount for a woman.
Mother said, he's smitten with Edmund Wooler's daughter.
Carries? Ralph smiled. He always liked her. We played together as children. She was a bossy little minx, but Merthyn never seemed to mind.
Will he marry her?
I expect so, Mother said, when he finishes his apprenticeship.
He'll have his hands full.
Ralph got up.
Where do you think he is now?
He's working in the north porch of the cathedral, Father said. But he might be having his dinner.
I'll find him.
Ralph kissed them both and went out. He returned to the priory and wandered through the fair. The rain had stopped, and the sun was shining fitfully, glinting in the puddles and raising steam off the stall holders' wet covers. He saw a familiar profile, and the regular footsteps of his heart faltered. It was the straight nose and strong jaw of Lady Philippa. She was older than Ralph, about 25, he guessed. She was standing at a stall looking at bolts of silk from Italy, and he drank in the way her light summer dress draped itself lasciviously over the curves of her hips. He made her an unnecessarily elaborate bow. She glanced up and gave a perfunctory nod.
Beautiful materials, he said, trying to open a conversation.
Yes. At that moment, a diminutive figure with untidy carrot-coloured hair approached. Merthyn. Ralph was delighted to see him.
This is my clever older brother, he said to Philippa.
Merthyn said to Philippa, buy the pale green. It matches your eyes. Ralph winced. Merthyn should not have addressed her in such a familiar way. However, she did not seem to mind too much. She spoke in a tone of mild reproof, saying, when I want a boy's opinion, I'll ask my son. But as she said it, she gave him a smile that was almost flirtatious.
Ralph said, this is the Lady Philippa, you fool. I apologize for my brother's cheek, my lady.
What's his name, anyway?
I'm Merthyn Fitzgerald, at your service any time you find yourself hesitating over silks.
Ralph took his arm and led him away before he could say anything else indiscreet.
I don't know how you do it, he said,
with exasperation and admiration equally mixed.
It matches her eyes, does it? If I said something like that, she'd have me flogged.
He was exaggerating, but it was true that Philippa usually responded sharply to insolence. He did not know whether to be amused or angry that she had been indulgent to Merthyn.
That's me, Merthyn said. Every woman's dream.
Ralph detected bitterness in his tone. Is anything wrong? He said. How's Carys?
I've done something stupid,
Merthyn replied. I'll tell you later. Let's look around while the sun's out. Ralph noticed a stall where a monk with ash-blonde hair was selling cheese.
Watch this, he said to Merthyn.
He approached the stall and said,
This looks tasty, brother. Where does it come from?
We make it at St. John in the Forest. It's a small cell or branch of Kingsbridge Priory. I'm the prior there. My name is Saul Whitehead. It makes me hungry to look at it. I wish I could buy some, but the Earl keeps us squires penniless.
The monk cut a slice off the wheel of cheese and gave it to Ralph.
Then you shall have some for nothing, in the name of Jesus, he said.
Thank you, Brother Saul.
As they walked away, Ralph grinned at Merthin and said,
See, as easy as taking an apple from a child.
And about as admirable,
Merthin said.
But what a fool to give his cheese away to anyone with a sob story.
He probably thinks it's better to risk being made a fool of than to deny food to a starving man.
You're a bit sour today.
How come you're allowed to cheek a noblewoman, but I can't talk a stupid monk into giving me free cheese?
Merthin surprised him with a grin.
Just like when we were boys, eh?
Exactly.
Now Ralph did not know whether to be angry or amused. Before he could make up his mind, a pretty girl approached him with eggs on a tray. She was slim with a small bust under a homespun dress, and he imagined her breasts to be pale and round like the eggs. He smiled at her.
How much? He said, though he had no need of eggs.
A penny for 12.
Are they good?
She pointed at a nearby stall.
They're from these hens.
And have the hens been well serviced by a healthy rooster?
Ralph saw Merthin roll up his eyes in mock despair at this sally. However, the girl played along.
Yes, sir,
she said with a smile.
Lucky hens, eh?
I don't know.
Of course not. A maid understands little of these things.
Ralph scrutinized her. She had fair hair and a turned-up nose. She was about 18, he guessed. She batted her eyelids and said,
Don't stare at me, please.
From behind the stall, a peasant, no doubt the girl's father, called.
Annette, come here.
So,
your name is Annette, Ralph said.
She ignored him.
Ralph said, Who is your father?
Perkin from Wigley.
Really? My friend Stephen is Lord of Wigley. Is Stephen good to you?
Lord Stephen is just and merciful, she said dutifully.
Her father called again.
Annette, you're wanted here.
Ralph knew why Perkin was trying to get her away. He would not mind if a squire wanted to marry his daughter. That would be a step up the social ladder for her. But he feared that Ralph wanted to dally with her, then discard her. And he was right.
Don't go, Annette Wigley, Ralph said.
Not until you've bought what I'm offering.
Beside them, Merthin groaned.
One is as bad as the other.
Ralph said, Why don't you put down the eggs and come with me? We could stroll along the river bank. Between the river and the wall of the priory grounds, there was a wide bank, covered at this time of year with wild flowers and bushes, where courting couples traditionally went. But Annette was not that easy.
My father would be displeased, she said.
Let's not worry about him.
There was not much a peasant could do to oppose the will of a squire, especially when the squire was wearing the livery of a great earl. It was an insult to the earl to lay hands on one of his servants. The peasant might try to dissuade his daughter, but it would be risky for him to restrain her forcibly. However, someone else came to Perkin's aid. A youthful voice said,
Hello, Annette. Is all well?
Ralph turned to the newcomer. He looked about 16, but he was almost as tall as Ralph, with broad shoulders and big hands. He was strikingly handsome, with regular features that might have been carved by a cathedral sculptor. He had thick, tawny hair and the beginnings of a beard the same color.
Ralph said, Who the hell are you?
I'm Wulfric from Wigley, sir.
Wulfric was deferential, but not afraid. He turned back to Annette and said,
I've come to help you sell some eggs.
The boy's muscular shoulder came between Ralph and Annette, his stance protecting the girl and at the same time excluding Ralph. It was mildly insolent, and Ralph felt a stirring of anger.
Get out of the way, Wulfric Wigley, he said.
You're not wanted here.
Wulfric turned again and gave him a level look. I'm betrothed to this woman, sir, he said. Once again the tone was respectful, but the attitude fearless. Perkins spoke up.
That's true, sir. They are to be married.
Don't talk to me about your peasant customs, Ralph said contemptuously. I don't care if she's married to the oaf.
It angered him to be spoken to this way by his inferiors. It was not their place to tell him what to do. Merthyn butted in. Let's go, Ralph, he said. I'm hungry, and Betty Baxter is selling hot pies.
Pies, Ralph said. I'm more interested in eggs.
He picked up one of the eggs on her tray and fondled it suggestively. Then he put it down and touched her left breast. It was firm to his fingertips, and egg-shaped.
What do you think you're doing?
She sounded indignant, but she did not move away. He squeezed gently, enjoying the sensation.
Examining the goods on offer.
Take your hands off me.
In a minute.
Then Wulfric shoved him violently. Ralph was taken by surprise. He had not expected to be attacked by a peasant. He staggered back, stumbled, and fell to the ground with a thump. He heard someone laugh, and amazement gave way to humiliation. He sprang to his feet, enraged. He was not wearing his sword, but he had a long dagger at his belt. However, it would be undignified to use weapons on an unarmed peasant. He could lose the respect of the Earl's knights and the other squires. He would have to punish Wulfric with his fists.
Perkins stepped from behind his stall, speaking rapidly. A clumsy mistake, sir, not intended. The lad is deeply sorry, I assure you.
However, his daughter seemed unafraid.
Boys, boys, she said in a tone of mock reprimand, but she seemed more pleased than anything else.
Ralph ignored them both. He took one step towards Wulfric and raised his right fist. Then, when Wulfric lifted both arms to defend his face from the blow, Ralph drove his left fist into the boy's belly. It was not as soft as he had expected. All the same, Wulfric bent forward, his face twisted in agony, both hands going to his midriff, whereupon Ralph hit him full in the face with his right fist, catching him high on the cheekbone. The punch hurt his hand, but brought joy to his soul. To his astonishment, Wulfric hit him back. Instead of crumpling to the floor and lying there waiting to be kicked, the peasant boy came back with a right-handed punch that had all the strength of his shoulders behind it. Ralph's nose seemed to explode in blood and pain. He roared with anger. Wulfric stepped back, seeming to realize what a terrible thing he had done, and he dropped both arms, holding his palms upwards. But it was too late to be sorry. Ralph hit him with both fists on the face and body, a storm of blows that Wulfric feebly tried to ward off by holding up his arms and ducking his head. As he punched him, Ralph wondered vaguely why the boy did not run away, and guessed he was hoping to take his punishment now rather than face worse later. He had guts, Ralph realized, but that made him even angrier. He hit him harder again and again, and he felt filled with a feeling that was both rage and ecstasy. Merthyn tried to intervene.
For the love of Christ, enough, he said, putting a hand on Ralph's shoulder, but Ralph shook him off.
At last, Wulfric's hands fell to his sides, and he staggered, dazed, his handsome face covered in blood, his eyes closing. Then he fell down. Ralph started to kick him. Then a burly man in leather trousers appeared and spoke with a voice of authority.
Now then, young Ralph, don't murder the boy.
Ralph recognized John, the town constable, and said indignantly,
He attacked me.
Well, he's not attacking you any more, is he, sir?
Lying on the ground like that with his eyes shut.
John put himself in front of Ralph.
I'd rather do without the trouble of a coroner's inquiry.
People crowded around Wulfric, Perkin, Annet, who was flushed with excitement, the Lady Philippa, and several bystanders. The ecstatic feeling left Ralph, and his nose hurt like hell. He could breathe only through his mouth. He tasted blood.
That animal
punched my nose, he said, and he sounded like a man with a heavy cold.
Then he shall be punished, said John. Two men who looked like Wulfric appeared, his father and his elder brother, Ralph guessed. They helped Wulfric to his feet, shooting angry glances at Ralph. Perkins spoke up. He was a fat man with a sly face.
The squire threw the first punch, he said.
Ralph said,
The peasant deliberately shoved me.
The squire insulted Wulfric's wife to be. The constable said,
No matter what the squire may have said, Wulfric should know better than to lay hands on a servant of Earl Rowland's. I should think the Earl will expect him to be severely dealt with.
Wulfric's father spoke up.
Is there a new law, John Constable, that says a man in livery may do what he likes?
There was a mutter of agreement from the small crowd now gathered. Young squires caused a lot of trouble, and often escaped punishment because they were wearing the colours of some baron, and this was deeply resented by law-abiding tradesmen and peasants. Lady Philippa intervened.
I'm the Earl's daughter-in-law, and I saw the whole thing, she said.
Her voice was low and melodious, but she spoke with the authority of high rank. Ralph expected her to take his side, but to his dismay she went on. I'm sorry to say that this was entirely Ralph's fault. He fondled the girl's body in a most outrageous way.
Thank you, my lady, John Constable said deferentially.
He lowered his voice to confer with her.
But I think the Earl might not want the peasant lad to go unpunished.
She nodded thoughtfully. We don't want this to be the start of a lengthy dispute. Put the boy in the stocks for 24 hours. It won't do him much harm at his age, but everyone will know that justice has been done. That will satisfy the Earl. I'll answer for him. John hesitated. Ralph could see that the constable did not like taking orders from anyone but his master, the Prior of Kingsbridge. However, Philippa's decision would surely satisfy all parties. Ralph himself would have liked to see Wulfric flogged, but he was beginning to suspect that he did not come out of this as a hero, and he would look worse if he demanded a harsh punishment. After a moment, John said,
Very well, Lady Philippa, if you're willing to take responsibility.
I am.
Right.
John took Wulfric by the arm and led him away. The lad had recovered fast and was able to walk normally. His family followed. Perhaps they would bring him food and drink while he was in the stocks and make sure he was not pelted.
Merthyn said to Ralph, How are you?
Ralph felt as if the middle of his face was swelling like an inflated bladder. His vision was blurred, his speech was a nasal honk, and he was in pain.
I'm fine, he said, never better.
Let's get a monk to look at your nose.
No.
Ralph was not afraid of fights, but he hated the things physicians did, bleeding and cupping and lancing boils.
All I need is a bottle of strong wine. Take me to the nearest tavern.
All right, Merthyn said, but he did not move. He was giving Ralph a queer look.
Ralph said,
What's the matter with you?
You don't change, do you?
Ralph shrugged.
Does anyone?
Chapter 9. Godwin was completely fascinated by Timothy's book. It was a history of Kingsbridge Priory, and, like most such histories, it began with the creation by God of heaven and earth. But mostly it recounted the era of Prior Philip, 2 centuries ago, when the cathedral was built, a time now regarded by the monks as a golden age. The author, Brother Timothy, claimed that the legendary Philip had been a stern disciplinarian as well as a man of compassion. Godwin was not sure how you could be both. On the Wednesday of Fleece Fair week, in the study hour before the service of Sext, Godwin sat on a high stool in the monastery library, the book open on a lectern before him. This was his favourite place in the priory, a spacious room, well lit by high windows, with almost 100 books in a locked cupboard. It was normally hushed, but today he could hear, from the far side of the cathedral,
the muffled roar of the fair. 1,000 people buying and selling, haggling and quarrelling, calling their wares, and shouting encouragement at cockfighting and bear-baiting. At the back of the book, later authors had tracked the descendants of the cathedral builders down to the present day. Godwin was pleased, and frankly surprised, to find confirmation of his mother's theory that she was descended from Tom Builder, through Tom's daughter, Martha. He wondered what family traits might have come down from Tom. A mason needed to be a shrewd businessman, he supposed, and Godwin's grandfather and his uncle Edmund had that quality. His cousin Caris also showed signs of the same flair. Perhaps Tom had also had the green eyes flecked with yellow that they all shared. Godwin also read about Tom Builder's stepson, Jack, the architect of Kingsbridge Cathedral, who had married the Lady Aliena and fathered a dynasty of Earls of Shiring. He was the ancestor of Caris's sweetheart, Merthyn Fitzgerald. That made sense. Young Merthyn was already showing unparalleled ability as a carpenter. Timothy's book even mentions Jack's red hair, which had been inherited by Sir Gerald and Merthyn, though not Ralph. What interested him most was the book's chapter on women. It seemed there had been no nuns at Kingsbridge in Prior Philip's day. Women had been strictly forbidden to enter the monastery buildings. The author, quoting Philip, said that if possible a monk should never look at a female for his own peace of mind. Philip disapproved of combined monastery nunneries, saying the advantages of shared facilities were outweighed by the opportunities for the devil to introduce temptation. When there was a double house, the separation of monks and nuns should be as rigid as possible, he added. Godwin felt the thrill of finding authoritative support for a pre-existing conviction. At Oxford, he had enjoyed the all-male environment of Kingsbridge College. The university teachers were men, as were the students, without exception. He had hardly spoken to a female for 7 years, and, if he kept his eyes on the ground as he walked through the city, he could even avoid looking at them. On his return to the priory, he had found it disturbing to see nuns so frequently. Although they had their own cloisters, refectory, kitchen, and other buildings, he met them constantly in the church, the hospital, and other communal areas. At this moment, there was a pretty young nun, called Mare, just a few feet away, consulting an illustrated book on medicinal herbs. It was even worse to encounter girls from the town, with their close-fitting clothes and alluring hairstyles, casually walking through the priory grounds on everyday errands, bringing supplies to the kitchen or visiting the hospital. Clearly, he thought, the priory had fallen from Philip's high standards, another example of the slackness that had crept in under the rule of Antony, Godwin's uncle. But perhaps there was something he could do about this. The bell rang for sext, and he closed the book. Sister Mare did the same and smiled at him, her red lips forming a sweet curve as she did so. He looked away and hurried out of the room. The weather was improving, the sun shining fitfully between showers of rain. In the church, the stained glass windows brightened and faded as patchy clouds blew across the sky. Godwin's mind was equally restless, distracted from his prayers by thoughts of how he could best use Timothy's book to inspire a revival in the priory. He decided he would raise the subject at chapter, the daily meeting of all the monks. The builders were getting on quickly with the repairs to the chancel after last Sunday's collapse, he noted. The rubble had been cleared away and the area had been roped off. There was a growing stack of thin, lightweight stones in the transept. The men did not stop work when the monks began to sing. There were so many services during the course of a normal day that the repairs would have been severely delayed. Merthyn Fitzgerald, who had temporarily abandoned his work on the new door, was in the south aisle, constructing an elaborate spiderweb of ropes, branches, and hurdles on which the masons would stand as they rebuilt the vaulted ceiling. Thomas Langley, whose job it was to supervise the builders, was standing in the south transept with Elfric, pointing with his one arm at the collapsed vault, obviously discussing Merthyn's work. Thomas was effective as matricularius,
He was decisive, and he never let things slip. Any morning the builders failed to show up, a frequent irritation, Thomas would go and find them and demand to know why. If he had a fault, it was that he was too independent. He rarely reported progress or asked Godwin's opinion, but got on with the work as if he were his own master rather than Godwin's subordinate. Godwin had an annoying suspicion that Thomas doubted his ability. Godwin was younger, but only slightly. He was 31, Thomas 34. Perhaps Thomas thought that Godwin had been promoted by Antony under pressure from Petronilla. However, he showed no other sign of resentment. He just did things his own way. As Godwin watched, murmuring the responses of the service automatically, Thomas's conversation with Elfric was interrupted. Lord William of Castor came striding into the church. He was a tall, black-bearded figure, very like his father, and equally harsh, though people said he was sometimes softened by his wife, Philippa. He approached Thomas and waved Elfric away. Thomas turned to William, and something in his stance reminded Godwin that Thomas had once been a knight, and had first arrived at the priory bleeding from the sword wound that had eventually necessitated the amputation of his left arm at the elbow. Godwin wished he could hear what Lord William was saying. William was leaning forward, speaking aggressively, pointing a finger. Thomas, unafraid, answered with equal vigor. Godwin suddenly remembered Thomas having just such an intense, combative conversation 10 years ago, on the day he arrived here. On that occasion, he had been arguing with William's younger brother, Richard, then a priest, now the Bishop of Kingsbridge. Perhaps it was fanciful, but Godwin imagined they were quarrelling about the same thing today. What could it be? Could there really be an issue between a monk and a noble family that was still a cause of anger after 10 years? Lord William stamped off, evidently unsatisfied, and Thomas turned back to Elfric. The argument 10 years ago had resulted in Thomas's joining the priory. Godwin recalled that Richard had promised a donation to secure Thomas's admittance. Godwin had never heard any more about that donation. He wondered if it had ever been paid. In all that time, no one at the priory seemed to have learned much about Thomas's former life. That was curious. Monks gossiped constantly. Living closely together in a small group, they were 27 at present, they tended to know almost everything about one another. What lord had Thomas served? Where had he lived? Most knights ruled over a few villages, receiving rents that enabled them to pay for horses, armor, and weapons. Had Thomas had a wife and children? If so, what had become of them? No one knew. Apart from the mystery of his background, Thomas was a good monk, devout and hard-working. It seemed as if this existence suited him better than his life as a knight. Despite his former career of violence, there was something of the woman about him, as there was about many monks. He was very close to Brother Matthias, a sweet-natured man a few years younger than he. But, if they were committing sins of impurity, they were very discreet about it, for no accusation had ever been made. Towards the end of the service, Godwin glanced into the deep gloom of the nave and saw his mother, Petronilla, standing as still as one of the pillars, a shaft of sunlight illuminating her proud grey head. She was alone. He wondered how long she had been there, watching. Lay people were not encouraged to attend the weekday services, and Godwin guessed she was here to see him. He felt the familiar mixture of pleasure and apprehension. She would do anything for him, he knew. She had sold her house and become her brother Edmund's housekeeper, just so that he could study at Oxford. And when he thought of the sacrifice that entailed for his proud mother, he wanted to weep with gratitude. Yet her presence always made him anxious, as if he were going to be reprimanded for some transgression. As the monks and nuns filed out, Godwin peeled off from the procession and approached her. "Good morning, Mama." She kissed his forehead. "You look thin," she said with maternal anxiety. "Aren't you getting enough to eat?" "Salt fish and porridge, but there's plenty of it," he said. "What are you so excited about?"
She could always read his mood. He told her about Timothy's book. "I could read the passage during chapter," he said. "Would others support you?" "Theodoric and the younger monks would. A lot of them find it disturbing to see women all the time. After all, they have all chosen to live in an all-male community." She nodded approvingly. "This casts you in the role of leader. Excellent. Besides, they like me because of the hot stones." "Hot stones? I introduced a new rule in the winter. On frosty nights, when we go into church for matins, each monk is given a hot stone wrapped in a rag. It prevents them getting chilblains in their feet." "Very clever. All the same, check your support before you make your move." "Of course, but it fits in with what the masters teach at Oxford." "Which is?" "Mankind is fallible, so we should not rely on our own reasoning. We cannot hope to understand the world. All we can do is stand amazed at God's creation. True knowledge comes only from revelation. We should not question received wisdom." Mother looked skeptical, as laypeople often did when educated men tried to explain high philosophy. "And this is what bishops and cardinals believe?" "Yes. The University of Paris has actually banned the works of Aristotle and Aquinas because they are based on rationality rather than faith." "Will this way of thinking help you find favor with your superiors?" That was all she really cared about. She wanted her son to be prior, bishop, archbishop, even cardinal. He wanted the same, but he hoped he was not as cynical as she. "I'm sure of it," he replied. "Good. But that's not why I came to see you. Your uncle Edmund has suffered a blow. The Italians are threatening to take their custom to Shiring." Godwin was shocked. "That will ruin his business." But he was not sure why she had made a special visit to tell him. "Edmund thinks he can win them back if we improve the fleece fair, and in particular if we tear down the old bridge and build a new, wider one." "Let me guess. Uncle Antony refused. But Edmund has not given up. You want me to talk to Antony?" She shook her head. "You can't persuade him. But if the subject comes up in chapter, you should support the proposal." "And go against Uncle Antony?" "Whenever a sensible proposal is opposed by the old guard, you must be identified as leader of the reformers." Godwin smiled admiringly. "Mama, how do you know so much about politics?" "I'll tell you." She looked away, her eyes focusing on the great rose window at the east end, her mind in the past. "When my father started to trade with the Italians, he was treated as an upstart by the leading citizens of Kingsbridge. They turned up their noses at him and his family, and did everything they could to prevent him implementing his new ideas. My mother was dead by then, and I was an adolescent, so I became his confidant, and he told me everything." Her face, normally fixed in an expression of frozen calm, twisted now into a mask of bitterness and resentment. Her eyes narrowed, her lip curled, and her cheek flushed with remembered shame. "He decided he would never be free of them until he took control of the parish guild. So that's what he set out to do, and I helped him." She drew a deep breath, as if once again gathering her strength for a long war. "We divided the ruling group, set one faction against the other, made alliances, then shifted them, ruthlessly undermined our opponents, and used our supporters until it suited us to discard them. It took us 10 years, and, at the end of it, he was alderman of the guild and the richest man in town." She had told him the story of his grandfather before, but never in quite such bluntly honest terms. "So you were his aide, as Caris is to Edmund?" She gave a short, harsh laugh. "Yes, except that by the time Edmund took over, we were the leading citizens. My father and I climbed the mountain, and Edmund just had to walk down the other side."
They were interrupted by Philemon. He came into the church from the cloisters, a tall, scrawny-necked man of 22, walking like a bird with short, pigeon-toed steps. He carried a broom. He was employed by the priory as a cleaner. He seemed excited.
"I've been looking for you, Brother Godwin."
Petronilla ignored his obvious hurry. "Hello, Philemon. Haven't they made you a monk yet?"
"I can't raise the necessary donation, Mistress Petronilla. I come from a humble family."
"But it's not unknown for the priory to waive the donation in the case of an applicant who shows devotion. And you've been a servant of the priory, paid and unpaid, for years."
"Brother Godwin has proposed me, but some of the older monks argued against me."
Godwin put in, "Blind Carlos hates Philemon. I don't know why." Petronilla said, "I'll speak to my brother Anthony. He should overrule Carlos. You're a good friend to my son. I'd like to see you get on."
"Thank you, mistress."
"Well, you're obviously bursting to tell Godwin something that can't be said in front of me, so I'll take my leave." She kissed Godwin. "Remember what I said."
"I will, Mama."
Godwin felt relieved, as if a storm cloud had passed overhead and gone on to drench some other town. As soon as Petronilla was out of earshot, Philemon said,
"It's Bishop Richard."
Godwin raised his eyebrows. Philemon had a way of learning people's secrets. "What have you found out?"
"He's in the hospital, right now, in one of the private rooms upstairs, with his cousin Marjorie."
Marjorie was a pretty girl of 16. Her parents, a younger brother of Earl Roland and a sister of the Countess of Mar, were both dead, and she was Roland's ward. He had arranged for her to marry a son of the Earl of Monmouth, in a political alliance that would greatly strengthen Roland's position as the leading nobleman of southwest England.
"What are they doing?"
Godwin said, though he could guess. Philemon lowered his voice.
"Kissing."
"How do you know?"
"I'll show you."
Philemon led the way out of the church, via the south transept, through the monks' cloisters, and up a flight of steps to the dormitory. It was a plain room with two rows of simple wooden bedsteads, each having a straw mattress. It shared a party wall with the hospital. Philemon went to a large cupboard that contained blankets. With an effort, he pulled it forward. In the wall behind it there was a loose stone. Momentarily, Godwin wondered how Philemon had come across this peephole, and guessed he might have hidden something in the gap. Philemon lifted the stone out, careful to make no noise, and whispered,
"Look, quick."
Godwin hesitated. In a low voice he said, "How many other guests have you observed from here?"
"All of them,"
Philemon replied, as if that should have been obvious. Godwin thought he knew what he was going to see, and he did not relish it. Peeping at a misbehaving bishop might be all right for Philemon, but it seemed shamefully underhand. However, his curiosity urged him on. In the end he asked himself what his mother would advise, and knew immediately that she would tell him to look. The hole in the wall was a little below eye level. He stooped and peeked through. He was looking into one of the two private guest rooms upstairs at the hospital. In one corner stood a prie-dieu, facing a wall painting of the crucifixion. There were two comfortable chairs and a couple of stools. When there was a crowd of important guests, the men took one room and the women the other, and this was clearly the women's room, for on a small table were several distinctly feminine articles, combs, ribbons, and mysterious small jars and vials. On the floor were two straw mattresses. Richard and Marjorie lay on one of them. They were doing more than kissing. Bishop Richard was an attractive man with wavy, mid-brown hair and regular features. Marjorie was not much more than half his age, a slender girl with white skin and dark eyebrows. They lay side by side. Richard was kissing her face and speaking into her ear. A smile of pleasure played upon his fleshy lips. Marjorie's dress was pushed up around her waist. She had beautiful, long, white legs. His hand was between her thighs, moving with a practiced, regular motion. Although Godwin had no experience of women, somehow he knew what Richard was doing. Marjorie looked at Richard adoringly, her mouth half open, panting with excitement, her face flushed with passion. Perhaps it was mere prejudice, but Godwin sensed intuitively that Richard saw Marjorie as a plaything of the moment, whereas Marjorie believed Richard was the love of her life. Godwin stared at them for a horrified moment. Richard moved his hand, and suddenly Godwin was looking at the triangle of coarse hair between Marjorie's thighs, dark against her white skin, like her eyebrows. Quickly, he looked away.
"Let me see," said Philemon.
Godwin moved away from the wall. This was shocking, but what should he do about it, if anything? Philemon looked through the hole and gave a gasp of excitement.
"I can see a cunt," he whispered. "He's rubbing it."
"Come away from there," Godwin said. "We've seen enough. Too much." Philemon hesitated, fascinated. Then, reluctantly, he moved away and replaced the loose stone.
"We must expose the bishop's fornication at once," he said. "Shut your mouth and let me think," Godwin said.
If he did as Philemon suggested, he would make enemies of Richard and his powerful family, and to no purpose. But surely there was a way something like this could be turned to advantage. Godwin tried to think about it as his mother would. If there was nothing to be gained by revealing Richard's sin, was it possible to make a virtue of concealing it? Perhaps Richard would be grateful to Godwin for keeping it. That was more promising, but for it to work, Richard had to know that Godwin was protecting him. "Come with me," Godwin said to Philemon. Philemon moved the cupboard back into place. Godwin wondered whether the sound of wood scraping on the floor was audible in the next room. He doubted it, and anyway, Richard and Marjorie were surely too absorbed in what they were doing to notice noises from beyond the wall. Godwin led the way down the stairs and through the cloisters. There were two staircases to the private rooms. One led up from the hospital's ground floor, and the other was outside the building, permitting important guests to come and go without passing through the common people's quarters. Godwin hurried up the outside stairs. He paused outside the room where Richard and Marjorie were, and spoke to Philemon quietly.
"Follow me in," he said. "Do nothing. Say nothing. Leave when I leave."
Philemon put down his broom.
"No," Godwin said. "Carry it." "All right."
Godwin threw open the door and strode in.
"I want this chamber immaculately clean," he said loudly. "Sweep every corner." "Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought the room was empty."
In the time it had taken Godwin and Philemon to rush from the dormitory to the hospital, the lovers had progressed. Richard now lay on top of Marjorie, his long clerical robe lifted in front. Her shapely white legs stuck straight up in the air either side of the bishop's hips. There was no mistaking what they were doing. Richard ceased his thrusting motion and looked at Godwin, his expression a mixture of angry frustration and frightened guilt. Marjorie gave a cry of shock, and she, too, stared at Godwin with fear in her eyes. Godwin drew the moment out.
"Bishop, Richard,"
he said, feigning bewilderment. He wanted Richard to be in no doubt that he had been recognized.
"But how? And Marjorie?"
He pretended to understand suddenly.
"Forgive me."
He spun on his heel. He shouted at Philemon.
"Get out now!"
Philemon scuttled back through the door, still clutching his broom. Godwin followed, but he turned at the door to make sure Richard got a good look at him. The two lovers remained frozen in position, locked in sexual congress, but their faces had changed. Marjorie's hand had flown to her mouth in the eternal gesture of surprised guilt. Richard's expression had become frantically calculating. He wanted to speak, but he could not think what to say. Godwin decided to put them out of their misery. He had done everything he needed to do. He stepped out. Then, before he could close the door, a shock made him stop. A woman was coming up the stairs. He suffered a moment of panic. It was Philippa, the wife of the Earl's other son. He realized instantly that Richard's guilty secret would lose its value if someone else knew it. He had to warn Richard.
"Lady Philippa," he said in a loud voice, "welcome to Kingsbridge Priory."
Urgent scuffling noises came from behind him. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Richard leap to his feet. Luckily, Philippa did not march straight past, but stopped and spoke to Godwin.
"Perhaps you can help me."
From where she stood, she could not quite see into the room.